Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Once upon a time, higher education had the support from all kinds of people, Democrats, Republicans, governors, and lawmakers. But times have changed. Now, as the Chronicle of Higher Education points out in a recent report, we've come to a precipice. College students once paid for about a third of the cost of their education. Now they pay most of it. And the situation is only worsening. And tell me about it. I've got one son who just finished his freshman year and another son 2 years away from his. We'll talk about all this today, and later we'll talk about a student seating controversy over at Allen Fieldhouse in Lawrence, and Brian McTavish will swing by with the weekend to-do list. But first, the higher education crisis, and I should point out that in addition to writing for The Star and hosting this show, I'm a journalism professor over at UMKC. With me this morning is Jack Stripling. He's a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education and co-author of An Era of Neglect, How Public Colleges Were Crowded Out, Beaten Up, and Failed to Fight Back. And Jack, so good to have you in Kansas City.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's a powerful report title, Jack. When did the era of neglect actually begin?
Well, we've looked back at this over probably the last 50-year period. If you go back to the mid-40s, This is when we had the GI Bill, and this was a huge public investment in public higher education that sent hundreds of thousands of people to college. That transition by the mid-1990s had really already begun. We saw the rhetoric start to change around public higher education. We saw changes in tax policy in states that really made it difficult for lawmakers to invest in public higher education. And so I think it's really over the course of a generation, we've seen a fundamental shift.
And the shift is what exactly? That lawmakers in so many states have other priorities, Jack? Or what's happening out there?
Well, one thing that we look at is the cost that an individual student pays to go to college.
I was going to ask.
Yeah. So if you look at that figure, back in 2000, taxpayers paid more than students in nearly every state in the country to the cost of sending them to school. By 2012, taxpayers paid less than students in more than half of the states. So it's completely flipped. Now it's the burden shifts to the individual student. And I think that has to do with a philosophical shift as well. I think as we talk to people around the country, there is a movement behind the idea that somebody goes to college, they ought to pay for it. It's their individual benefit. That's a major shift from 30 years ago or 50 years ago, when the idea was that this is a collective investment in improving the social capital of the country, and therefore it's not the sole responsibility of the student to pay for it.
And that's a huge change in thinking. And I mentioned before the show that as I cover Jefferson City, as I cover Topeka, I've seen that change in thinking firsthand, that suddenly higher education, going to college, is viewed more as an entitlement than it is something that is something in a different category, I guess.
Yeah, and I think it has also to do with the reputation of the sector itself. We write about disinvestment in higher education as a problem of shared responsibility, and I don't think we can let the colleges off the hook here. They haven't done a lot to ingratiate themselves to the public. I write every day about a different president who's getting fired for whatever reason. We write about reckless spending. People read about all the expenditures in sports and other areas, and they wonder whether these folks are really good stewards of the money they receive. And so I think that's very much informing this conversation, and it's giving folks who want to disinvest a very good reason to do so.
We'll put a link to your article, your very good article, An Era of Neglect, How Public Colleges Were Crowded Out, Beaten Up, and Failed to Fight Back, on our website at kcur.org. You tell some great stories in this report, and one of them has to do with a lobbyist from South Carolina who represented auto dealers and back a number of years ago, and the fight he waged to preserve a tax credit, basically, for folks who buy new cars. Tell us about that and the impact that decision had on higher education in that state.
Sure. So the person you're referring to, his name is Pat Watson, and he was for about 30 years the top auto lobbyist in the city of South Carolina. Fascinating guy. He was a football player for the University
in Columbia,
of South Carolina.
I think, right?
Yeah, he played for the Gamecocks and, you know, captained the football team that won them their only SEC championship, which he'll tell you about. And so he's a real good old boy and a smooth talker. And back in the mid-1980s, the governor of that state wanted to put in place a one-penny sales tax that would fund K-12. everybody seemed to think the idea was okay, but car dealers thought that this was going to just destroy their industry, that if anybody had to pay an extra penny of sales tax on a Lamborghini, that would be the reason they didn't buy it. And so he managed through force of will and charisma to really – I mean, he would be more modest than this, but I think he single-handedly created a situation where car dealers were exempted from that tax. And now, since the mid-1980s, South Carolina has had what they call the cap. So it's $300 in sales tax on any car, plane, or boat that's purchased in that state, regardless of the cost of it. It's incredibly regressive. In the last year, it cost the state $169 million in uncollected taxes. That'd be about enough to restore half of the cuts that have been given to higher education since the recession. So when we talk to people about stories like this, it's not directly, doesn't seem directly related to higher education, but it's a reflection of conscious choices that are made every day in states that down the line tie the hands of lawmakers who have less money to work with.
Yeah, that's a very tangible example you just cited, Jack. The other thing this lobbyist talked about, and I love this quote, absolutely loved it. This is from 1984, and this lobbyist is working hard to preserve the tax break for buying new cars. And he said this about higher education: if you can learn how to make love in the back seat of a Volkswagen, you can learn to read and write in a barn. I mean, that's the attitude, that's the change in thinking about higher education that you're talking about here.
Yeah, I mean, Watson's a great guy to reflect that sentiment. he's very skeptical of all the esoteric research that's going on in public universities. He's not sure that students are really getting practical skills. He probably thinks you're better off learning to do a trade like plumbing than reading literature like his son majored in. Mm-hmm. And so it reflects a certain level of skepticism about the work that colleges and universities do and whether you need all this fancy pants technology to really teach somebody.
You know, one part of your title of your report is this notion that colleges fail to fight back against these changing tides out there, Jack. How do colleges fail to fight back?
You know, I had an interesting South Carolina was one of three states that we looked at. We also looked at Michigan and Colorado, but this brings up another South Carolina example. I spoke to a lobbyist who worked in South Carolina during a pretty difficult period there, and he candidly told me that he felt that they were often off message. Part of the problem is that individual colleges and universities want to get what they can out of the legislature, so they don't portray a united front. And when everybody's out there making secret deals, it's probably not in the best long-term interest of the institution. He literally told me, this lobbyist, he said, you know, I'd be standing waiting in the wings for a lawmaker to come out to tell them the system's position on a particular issue. And behind me were four or five lobbyists from all the other colleges there to undermine everything I was saying. This is a sort of circular firing squad phenomenon that we see happening. And higher education isn't the only sector that has this problem, but it's also a state agency that doesn't think that it has to be a state agency. Mm-hmm. There's something people
We're
who are
above that.
Yes,
kind of thing.
They don't think they should have to be, and they're really fighting it out with the auto lobbyist. Well, newsflash, they do, and if they don't, they will be defeated.
Let me get our listeners involved here. Why do you think the cost of college is increasing? What do you make of it? What kind of impact, if you have kids in college, has it had on your household budget? I can only imagine the horror stories out there. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. We're visiting with Jack Stripling, a reporter for the Chronicle and co-author of An Era of Neglect, How Public Colleges Were Crowded Out, Beaten Up, and Failed to Fight Back. Are you seeing any change? You know, has the pendulum at all begun to swing back at all, Jack? Or are we still, at least from a higher education perspective, still on a downward slide here in a sense?
Well, there's no question we're on a downward slide. I mean, if you look at a state like Colorado, for example, projections suggest that within 10 years, there will literally be no state money at all going to those institutions.
In 10 years, no state money.
Right. So this is a domino effect. The reason that I am not sure that there's an optimistic answer to your question is because the rhetoric that you describe is very powerful and seems to be increasingly powerful. A, this is an individual benefit that students ought to pay for, and B, we simply don't have the money to finance this in the ways we once did. That's based on the idea that these are cyclical funding cycles, that higher education does well when everybody else does well and it doesn't do as good when there are recession periods. While that is true, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that even when times are good, states are not backfilling the university coffers in the way they once did.
And so one of your conclusions then in this report is that higher education has come to a precipice. You mean what exactly when you say precipice?
The precipice is the notion that the student will be the primary funder of his or her education and the taxpayer will start to fade away as a legitimate partner in that endeavor.
Do you have a sense, you know, if maybe I'm reaching too far here, but if all public aid for higher education evaporated, what does that do to tuition costs across the country? Do you have any just a rough feel for what that means ultimately?
Well, I mean, that's the place they have. They have a few places they can turn, colleges that are starved of state money. They can raise tuition. They can go out and raise private money that they can, you know, turn for philanthropy and other things. But, you know, as a college president told me last night, philanthropy doesn't pay the light bill. You know, no one wants to give money to a college or university to do the basic things that it costs to run an institution. They want their name on a building.
Yeah.
And so there are real limits to what can be done with philanthropy. And there are also real limits to the types of institutions that can do that. You know, if you have a big time football team that plays every Saturday morning in the fall and has a ton of eyeballs and wealthy alumni and donors, that's very different than an urban serving institution that doesn't produce alumni that doesn't captivate the imagination in the same way.
You know, is there a feeling in the higher education establishment, maybe the public higher education establishment, Jack, when it comes to the basic question of who should be paying for college, who should pay for higher education? Is there a formula out there that exists that is recommended by the Chronicle for higher Education or public colleges and universities across the country?
Well, I think that I don't know where the sweet spot is, to be honest with you. I mean, should a student pay none of the cost? Should he pay 50% of the cost? Should he pay 75%? The fact is that no one is even having the conversation. Mm-hmm. No one is even really debating from a public policy standpoint what is appropriate. So the starting point of the conversation you're describing would be even acknowledging that we've shifted this fundamentally.
And have you seen a state even answer that question? Has any state taken a policy position that says, you know, Rhode Island, I'm making up a state, that we will fund 50% of the cost of our public higher four-year higher education establishments?
You know, as a matter of policy, I don't think I've seen that. That doesn't mean it hasn't happened. But
that's interesting, isn't it?
I think it's telling. I mean, the way we started this story was to talk about how a lot of this seemed to happen without people noticing. You know, I think that people like yourself worry about tuition increases and how that affects their ability to afford pay for their sons and daughters to go to college. But drawing a direct correlation between those tuition increases and the really dramatic cuts in state funding, maybe that's not something that Joe Sixpack does as much.
Yeah. Maybe we should ask our listeners here. That'd be a great question. What percentage of higher education should the student pay? How much should the state pick up as a way to further progress economic development and make for a better society going forward? 816-235-2888. Let's go to Mike from Lawrence. Mike, you're on Up to Date.
Thanks for taking my call. I had a kind of quick focused question. And you kind of hit on it a little bit not too long ago. What part do financial institutions at large universities and student loan lending lobbying groups do to make sure that it costs more so that they have to loan more? Or is that just something that appears that way that may not be based in reality? That's my question.
If I understand the question, are you saying that people who profit from giving loans to students have an incentive to see the cost go up?
Because they have to loan more.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm right by KU right now, and that's exactly what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything statistical that looks at that as a cost driver. As you may know, this particular presidential administration has really taken a real hard look at student lending practices and the rates that are charged to students, and we've seen a lot of hullabaloo in New York State over the same thing. So that industry is under fire. Now, whether that's a key driver of what we're seeing, I haven't heard that.
Well, what is happening across the country, Jack, to keep a lid on the rising costs of college education and tuition? What is happening?
Well, we're seeing a lot of theories floated right now. I think we're in kind of an incubation period of a lot of interesting ideas. Some of your listeners may have heard of MOOCs, these massive online open courses. You know, the idea that a prestigious institution like MIT could offer a free course to the masses and help people accelerate their way through the process of earning a degree. The problem that we're already seeing on that, though, is that that's real fine and good for an upper middle class student who's taken advanced placement courses her whole life. If you put a first generation college student who hasn't had all of the advantages, doesn't have all of the counseling, doesn't have the support at home, those people tend to not do nearly as well in that type of environment that is really principally, you know, predicated on self-motivation. So all these interesting things are being floated about how technology might reduce costs, but whether that is in reality going to happen is a matter of serious debate.
Do you see online education sort of taking off? What's your reporting shown in that area?
Yeah, I mean, everybody will tell you that they do a blended course that's part online, part lecture. They want to maximize the way they use class space and use technology to cut down on, you know, how they have to use brick and mortar. But like I said, you know, this is not something that professors are naturally acclimated to do necessarily. You know, so there's a lot of training. There's a lot of discussion that goes into changes in pedagogy and these approaches. And so it's not a magic bullet. And the idea that it's cost neutral is just not true. I mean, setting these things in motion costs money as well, even if you don't have to build a building.
Again, our number here, 816-235-2888. We're talking with Jack Stripling. He's with the Chronicle of Higher Education about a new report he has out about the skyrocketing costs for kids to go to college these days. We want to know the impact about that higher education is having on your household budget. And what percentage of tuition should students pay? What should the state pick up? What makes sense to you? 816-235-2888 is our number here. Let's go to Don from Overland Park. Don, you're on Up to Date.
Hello, Steve. I am running for the state legislature, and one of my campaign issues is going to be that I propose let's knock $4,000 per semester off of every in-state student at a Kansas college and their state-funded college and university.
How would you pay for that, Don?
Well, a $14 billion state budget, that would be about $40 million, and that's not a whole lot if you're taking taking what fraction of the budget that is. And of course, I believe that the recently enacted tax cuts need to go away, so that we'll have enough money to fund Keep the Lights On in Kansas, and we can find $40 million for that program and those restoration of those cuts or repealing of those cuts.
Well, Don, as you go out campaigning door-to-door, what kind of reaction are you getting from your potential constituents here?
Jumping up and down with joy.
They like what they're hearing.
A lot of people have kids in school. A lot of people have grandchildren in school. A lot of people are students in school. Who wouldn't want to have their tuition cut by $8,000 a year?
Don, hang on a second. Jack, it's just a popular campaign issue across the country. You're picking up much of that. Candidates for office like Don who are advocating for lower tuition costs?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's enormously popular to promise that you're going to make college more affordable for students and their families. You know, if you look at a state like Florida where I grew up, there's a merit-based scholarship program there called Bright Futures that covers the cost of attendance for students who meet certain academic requirements, which are frankly not that high.
Mm-hmm.
And it's enormously popular, but it has – the argument college presidents would make is that it's artificially constrained the cost of tuition and has put them in a difficult bind where they need that revenue to support the academic enterprise. So your caller is going to get some pushback from presidents who will say that if we raise tuition, we're going to need more appropriations, and are your colleagues ready to approve that? Historically, they haven't.
Don?
that's the one thing I'm very concerned about. I do understand their constraints, their fiscal constraints. I want to make sure they're adequately funded, but I don't want it to be an excuse to raise costs and drive up spending that wouldn't have happened without this tuition break.
All right. Don, I appreciate the phone call. Good luck in the campaign, okay?
Thank you, Steve.
Let's go back to some calls here. Ben from Leawood. Ben, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. Milton Friedman, a noted conservative economist who won the Nobel Prize for something else, once said on public television that the government has a duty, a responsibility to pay for educating every citizen that they can to the full extent that they can absorb. But when they are through getting educated, they would be required to pay it all back.
Wow.
This has not had any strong support, but I'm wondering if this is something that really, as a citizenry, we should try to do, because if we cannot educate our citizenry, we are in bad shape. The GI Bill in the World War II was ecstatically successful, and why wouldn't one be just as successful now? I'll stay on if you want me to, or I'll take the answer off. What would you rather I do?
Well, Ben, hang on. I'll put you on hold here. Jack, what do you think?
Well, I think that gets at a broader question about the way the cost of higher education works.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of situations, tuition doesn't come close to actually covering what it costs to educate an individual student. So we'd have to have a real robust conversation about what paying it back really meant.
Yeah.
But your caller is right in as much as it's a policy position. I mean, right now we just simply don't have policy positions, and I think that's probably what's gotten us into this mess.
I was going to say, I think that's so true. You don't really see, at least the legislatures in Jeff City and in Topeka, and we'll talk about in our second half a little more about the situations in Kansas and Missouri, but you don't hear debates that really, you know, ask the questions that we're talking about here. What percentage of a higher education bill should a student pick up? How much should the state pay? What it really comes down to is, you know, they finagle with the state budget. They look at places where they can cut higher education, and, you know, to pay, make up shortfalls in various budgets across the spectrum in any state capital. And higher education winds up being a place where lawmakers can go to get a few bucks when they need them. That's sort of what it comes down to.
Yeah, in the desperate claw for diminishing dollars, there's not a lot of time for high-minded conversation about public policy.
Yeah.
I mean, we see individual colleges going out just trying to stop the bleeding, and they're not having a bigger policy conversation. In fact, they're often having those conversations amongst themselves. I mean, if you really want to hear people having policy conversations about higher education, attend one of the many boring conferences that I do. You know, I mean, there's plenty of conversation about it among academics, but there's a lot of preaching to the choir, reaching across into speaking with lawmakers and so forth. You know, these types of conversations don't lend themselves to elevator speeches.
Yeah. Let's do this, Jack. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here about the cost of higher education. We'll get phone calls from Alex and Teresa. We'll also talk about a comment from Michael, who's saying that the number one problem with universities being too expensive is paying professors too much. Well, Michael, I might have a little argument with you at some point here. And later on this hour, we'll talk with Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Well, this segment we're visiting with Jack Stripling. We're talking about the rising cost of higher education. He's a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, who helped write a report, An Era of Neglect, How Public Colleges Were Crowded Out, Beaten Up, and Failed to Fight Back, about the rising cost of college tuitions. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go back to some calls and go to Alex from Lenexa. Alex, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thanks, Alex.
I have questions about just what the role of students is in all this, which is who it ultimately affects. Like in the state, so in Kansas and Missouri, and then nationally, what are like student mobilization efforts, and how are they going?
Student mobilization. What are you seeing out there in terms of protests from students, Alex? If I understand you right,
and with administration, but also with government.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you actually hit on an interesting point, because if you look at the state of California, where, you know, protest is a part-time job for everybody, you know, we've seen a lot of demonstrations by students there, but their tuition has continued to go through the roof. And what I find interesting is that the student protest is often aimed at the college administration and not at Sacramento. For whatever reason, because the boards of these colleges are the ones that ultimately approve the tuition increases, they're the ones that get attacked. Students seem to seldom turn their sights on the people who are setting the policies that, that create that issue.
You know, Alex, I'm not seeing a whole lot of student protests in Kansas and Missouri, or am I missing something there?
No, well, the reason I ask is just because I've seen that as a big need that really doesn't, you know, isn't there. And so I'm part of a group called Higher Learning Movement that is fighting for these causes, mainly in Topeka, and this is all on the Kansas side. And so really, I was just wondering nationally what's been going on.
Well, what kind of reception are you getting, Alex, over in Lawrence?
I go to K-State, and so okay. This is in Manhattan. So really, the students are quite receptive, and administration to an extent is receptive as well. But I do think it's a need, but we'll see in this upcoming election this summer and this fall, if the student voting bloc is a reliable group for legislators to listen to.
Alex, didn't the Kansas Board of Regents just announce tuition increases of like what, 5.5%? I want to recall here.
For K-State, it's 5.5. I'm not quite sure what it is for the other regents.
Okay. Both. Okay. Well, good luck with your work, and give us a report sometime about how it's going. Okay.
Will do. Thank you.
Thanks, Alex. This comment from Michael I mentioned before the break, Jack, the number one problem with universities being too expensive is paying professors too much. How true is that?
Well, there's some data out there that shows that professorial pay hasn't really changed meaningfully in a number of years, and you can go to any campus in the country and you'll find people that haven't gotten a raise in 5-6 years. I talk to college presidents all the time who say the only way they can really meaningfully impact somebody's wages is to hire a new person. Giving merit increases and this type of thing just simply isn't happening on most campuses since the recession started. You know, the other aspect of this is, for every med school faculty member that we see making well into the six figures, you can rest assured that most colleges across the country are relying most heavily upon an army of adjunct professors who are lucky to make a living wage. And so that's completely changing the professionalism of the academic enterprise, and it relates directly to these cost structures we're talking about.
You know, and I used to do that for a couple of semesters. I was an adjunct at UMKC, $2,500 a course. I've heard KU sometimes pays up to $4,000, and different schools pay, you know, more or less depending on what the school is. But I'm telling you, $2,500 for that course, they got their money's worth. I mean, it was a lot of weekends, and it was a lot of work.
And out in California, the term you hear is freeway flyers, literally adjuncts who teach two courses here, drive an hour to teach two courses somewhere else just to string together enough to make a living. So if you look at the professoriate as a whole, those are the people that are doing most of the teaching on most college campuses right now.
You know, I want to turn just for a few minutes, Jack, to the situation in Missouri and Kansas and talk a little bit more there. You know, on Tuesday, just this week, Governor Nixon in Missouri withheld millions of bucks from the budget. The legislature's $26 billion budget for the fiscal year beginning next week included $100 million for a general revenue increase for the foundation formula, which funds K-12 public schools, $43 million more for higher ed institutions based on performance. But now the governor's withholding both unless the legislature sustains his vetoes of a series of tax breaks that they adopted on the final day of the session. Again, you know, when it comes to having to make decisions here, higher ed's a big pot of money. K-12 education, a big pot of money. Governors don't have a lot of choices in terms of places to go to cut big dollars when they have to do it. Education is often the target.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the issue, is that as much as we're talking about disinvestment, there's still just a ton of money goes to this sector. I mean, that's not to be disputed. The question is, if the demands on these institutions are to address an influx of students that we think we need to educate, and we're serious as a country about changing the completion rate, by which I mean that, you know, the number of individuals in this country who hold a bachelor's degree or more, then these institutions are going to have to absorb, you know, significant enrollment increases. And are they prepared to do that? If you look at Kansas, already taxpayers pay slightly less than students do. So students are paying more than taxpayers in Kansas already.
And when you say that, you mean in terms of gross dollars?
The cost of education per student. So what it costs to send a student through a university in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
That total cost is borne more heavily by students than taxpayers in Kansas. In Missouri, you're headed in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
It's not there yet. The taxpayer still funds a little bit more of the cost of education than the student. But that is, if that hasn't already tipped, it probably will.
And in how many states, again, do students pay the lion's share of this cost, Jack?
Yeah, so the most recent data we have on this is 2012, and taxpayers paid less than students in more than half of states. 26
taxpayers
states.
Paid less than students in more than half.
So right. Students bore more of the cost of their education in 26 states.
Okay, let's go back to some phone
calls
here.
Sorry to get a little mealing.
Lots of numbers there. Yeah. Kim from Belton. Kim, welcome to Up to Date.
My question is anything the athletic department and the ridiculous salaries that they're making, is there some reason that can't come down? I mean, I would think that ticket sales, that should be self-supporting for their salaries and not us having to pay such ridiculous amounts.
Right.
The athletic department, Jack, that's what Kim's talking about here.
Yeah, athletic department's an easy target, and rightfully so. There's very few college athletics programs in this country that actually are self-supporting. I mean, you've got a real rare number that that don't get some subsidy from the academic side of the house. So it's a fair question, and salaries are things that people hone in on. I think if at a macro level, if you look at the budgetary issues at play, in most cases, it's still a small portion of the overall budget. But symbolically, it's very hard for colleges to pay $1 million to a basketball coach and then cry poverty. I mean, that's a reality of optics that some colleges seem to fail to recognize.
I should point out that Jack Stripling of the Chronicle of Higher Education will be speaking at noon at the Chamber at Union Station. $15 to get in. You can still run down and see and hear more from Jack Stripling about all this. You've been just terrific, Jack. Thanks so much for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.